Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Dan, part of our audience comes from our podcasting partners. We thought our listeners would like to know more about podcasting. And we have an expert now who's written about it, talked about it, and knows an awful lot. Seth Green, he's the author of a fascinating new book, and he joins us now. Seth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here serving your listeners.
Well, Seth, tell us a little bit about your book, your background, and podcasting. Begin any place you want.
Sure. The book is called Market Domination for Podcasting. It is on the shelves at Barnes & Noble now. Your listeners can also go get a free downloadable copy at marketdominationllc.com/podcast. I wrote the book by interviewing some of the top podcasters in the world, folks with the followings in the millions or tens of millions, and then figuring out what they were doing to be so successful and translating that into how a business owner or entrepreneur could do that in a local marketplace without needing a giant budget or millions and millions of fans. I figured out how a small business owner could use a podcast to make themselves an authority in a very specific marketplace and use it to generate a lot of referrals and a lot of business, and that was the impetus behind the book.
Well, Seth, you're in the right place, and two very willing people ready to listen to you are Dan and myself. We started this program about 7 months ago, and it's really growing, but we're both sure you can tell us some of the things we should be doing to make it even better. So, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you to begin the questioning.
Thank you. Thank you, Seth, for joining us today. It is, as Don said, an important issue to us and to probably a lot of our listeners. I want to go back to something that you said. I come from the financial service business. I've been managing money for 40-some years. And my clients like to see what happens to their money. They like to see it go up. They don't like to see it go down. So numbers are an important thing. Or if they go down, they go down less than everybody else. But numbers are an important thing. And I heard you say briefly in your response to Don, podcasters with millions to many millions of listeners. What I would love to hear from you is some, and some of our listeners perhaps also, some basics. So I want to ask you some ignorance basic questions. And maybe you can answer them. Maybe we can get some people to consider getting your book. And we're going to have you tell the title of your book again, but much slower because I could just barely pick it up, so we want to make sure everybody gets it. And we'll put it on our website tonight after the show, but we've got people on live. So let's talk about numbers. Do you have a sense of how many people are podcasting in the United States right now?
Sure. There are about 60,000 podcasts right now with over 1 billion people listening to them. And in the next 3 years, that number is going to triple to 3 billion listeners.
Okay, we'll just take that number and let me ask you a question. Why is it going to triple?
Because of Apple CarPlay. Apple has a deal with almost every major car manufacturer to put the Apple Podcast interface as a native app on your dashboard in the next new car you get if you don't have it already. So you won't be able to delete that app even if you want to. So given the fact that the next new car you buy is going to have it pre-bundled on your dashboard, it's going to get the podcast exposed to a whole new audience.
Will that increase the number of podcasters or just increase the number of listeners?
It's projected to increase triple the number of listeners, but I have to believe with triple the market size, there will be more podcasters folks who are smart, like your listeners, who say, I want to get my piece of those 3 billion listeners.
So if you look at today, not you can certainly interpret, if you want to, what it will be 3 years from now. But if there are 60,000 podcasters that you say you believe are active in the United States today, what would be a typical audience for a podcaster?
It depends. So just because there are 60,000 podcasts doesn't mean they're successful. There are a large percentage of those 60,000 where they may have uploaded a couple episodes a year or two ago and haven't done anything since. So there are a lot of podcasts where they never got off the ground. The host never really did anything. They never really marketed it very well. So I wouldn't view 60,000 as my competition. If I wanted to see what my competition was, I would start looking at the active, successful podcast in my specific category in my market. So, for example, I'm the co-host of the Sharkpreneur podcast with Kevin Harrington from Shark Tank. So we are a business podcast first and foremost. We are a marketing podcast, and then the sub-niche in between both of those would be viewers of Shark Tank and venture capital-type reality shows. Mm-hmm. So we are a very successful business and marketing podcast, and considering there's only a handful of Shark Tank-related podcasts, we're certainly in the top of that category as well.
And what would your typical is the way to measure your podcast, the number of streaming per month, per week, per day, what?
It depends. So the traditional number of measuring podcast success is, you know, how many downloads you get per episode, whether if you're airing once a week, then it's weekly, it's airing more often than that, then that number would change. However, I would tell folks to think differently. I would tell you that the number that really matters is not the number of listeners to your podcast, but the ROI, the return on your investment. How much revenue are you generating with your podcast versus how much money are you spending to do it? And depending on what that ROI is, there are obviously podcasts with millions of listeners that aren't that successful from a financial standpoint. And we have clients who have podcasts that might have a few thousand listeners that are incredibly profitable. It just depends on your business model.
There's not a...
Dan, I'd like to jump in here and ask the $64 question. How do people find the advertisers that fuel the ROI?
Well, I'm going to add a caveat to that in that I would tell a local small business owner that advertising should not be the way they make money. Because in order to really be successful selling advertising on your podcast, you generally, the industry metric is you generally need about 10,000 listeners per show to attract advertisers. There are a number of podcast advertising networks where once you hit that number, you can submit your show, and then advertisers go look, search through the database, look for shows in the category that they're looking for, and will connect with you. So that's not the tricky part. I would say it's more important to make money without selling a single ad on your show, because the average entrepreneur probably isn't going to spend the money to build up that big a following. So we tell our clients that the ways to make money without selling ads are to use the podcast to get clients, to use the podcast to get referrals and centers of influence, and to use the podcast to increase their own client retention.
That's good advice. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying for a small business, the idea is to generate referrals, generate new customers, and that sort of thing, rather than depend on advertising. I'm probably repeating back, but I want to make sure I understood it correctly.
You do, and it's your industry. I've been a financial advisor for decades, so not as many as you, but a few. And so for a number of financial advisors that we provide this service for, some of the folks they're interviewing on their show are accountants, estate planning attorneys, divorce attorneys, other folks who see the affluent baby boomers they want as clients. So if I'm a financial advisor and I interview one of the most successful accountants in my city, and then he puts out on his social media, he sends an email out to his client base and says, look at me, I was featured on the show, you know, I'm an expert, because they interviewed me, all of a sudden his clients are listening to that show, they're watching that show, and they're not only seeing him, they're seeing the financial advisor. And they may say, hey, I've been thinking about getting a second opinion on my financial planning or my investments. I'm going to go see this guy that Joe, my accountant, just told me about.
Well, Dan, back to you.
Yeah, I want to go, Seth, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago. You talked about there is almost like a network clearinghouse, that if you have a certain audience size, you can go to that and they'll see whether or not there's an interest in what it is you have to offer. Do you recall that?
Yes, of course.
And what was the name of that?
There's a bunch of them. It's called the Podcast Advertising Network, and there's quite a few of them out there.
Podcast
Advertising Network. I'll give you an example. One of them is called Podbean.com. Another one is called AdvertiseCast.com. And these are networks where you submit your show, and then advertisers will go and look and try and find a show. And if there are advertisers in your industry, in your niche, they will find you looking on these sites. They will find you, connect with you, and start a conversation about advertising on your show.
And you're saying that in order to do that, our customers should probably have a podcast audience of at least 10,000 per show?
Correct. That's generally, there are some that might require more, there are some that require less, but that's generally the industry standard.
So, and as you go multiples of 10,000, like we heard this guy who has a car show, does 1 million downloads a week. He's probably one of these guys that makes millions of dollars.
If he's monetizing it correctly, he is. I'd love to talk to him about what he's doing with that.
Okay. And so let's go back. Let's just step back for a second. Let's talk about the services that you offer. What do you do for our small business clients?
We are a full-service direct response marketing firm, so our goal is to drive sales. So that may come about because we are producing their podcast and turning it into a book and then marketing both the show and the book to make them an authority in their marketplace. We do all the work. We're literally the small business owner would just show up once a week, do an interview that we scripted for them with a guest that we booked for them, and we would do everything else. We also offer other services in terms of social media marketing, in terms of internet marketing, in terms of direct mail. Basically, whatever way we can use to trackably generate sales. Because what matters to us is not brand building. It's not getting your name out there. It's being able to say, hey, John, we were able to generate 23 leads for you this week. Here's the Excel spreadsheet of all those leads who are interested in what you have to offer. Now, how many of those turned into business for you and how much money did you make?
I'd like to jump in, Dan, because you're a very modest man. But Dan has a new book out, which I think has to be a bestseller, which has to do with teaching teenagers about Alzheimer's. I believe that would be the type of show you would be thinking about. Am I wrong on that, Seth?
You could absolutely do that. You could be interviewing, you could have a show about Alzheimer's and interview tons of experts around the country, and then those doctors and gerontologists and neurologists and all of social workers and therapists would all be promoting that they were on the show to your audience, to their audiences, a number of whom are going to be, you know, parents or grandparents who are going to buy that book for their teenagers.
Okay. So how does a small business decide that they need your service? And is it available nationwide or is it a small area?
We are national, and how they decide they are interested in our services is they're spending money on marketing right now. They're not sure if it's working, or they know it's not working, or it's not working well enough. And then they call us and say, help, we want to improve the results of our marketing and actually know what we're getting for our money.
Can you do your service on a regional basis?
Yeah, we have a number of our clients who are local in a specific city or a specific market. And then we've got another 50% of our clients that are national.
Okay, so you do work on a local basis.
Absolutely. Half of our 50% of our client base are professional practices, financial advisor, doctor, lawyer, accountant, and they're all local in a specific sub-city.
Dan, can I jump in and ask you? I had a wild thought, and I'd like to ask you. I sit on the medical marijuana board here in New Jersey, and the laws of New Jersey are very strict about advertising, et cetera, but it doesn't preclude a podcasting. What do you think about a show about medical marijuana as a podcasting subject? Do you think people would be interested in that?
I think that the people who are interested in medical marijuana or consuming it are irrationally passionate about medical marijuana and would be a perfect audience for your podcast.
Clever.
Boy, you know, Seth, somebody recommended you on the show and said that you'd have so many ideas that you generate that we have time, thankfully, to talk more. But they were right in recommending you. Well, how did you get into this podcasting and this idea? It sounds fascinating.
Thank you. I had interviewed about 15 top marketers around the world for a book I wrote called Cutting Edge Marketing Magic. And about that time, I started listening to podcasts, and I said to myself, wait a minute, all these podcasts I'm listening to are basically interviews. I just did 15 interviews and recorded them for a book I'm writing. Why don't I toss these up as a podcast and see what happens? So it was completely unprofessional. I had no music. I had no audio. I had no sound effects. I had no intros. It was literally the raw, unedited telephone call that I recorded. I mean, you had heard the ringing of the phone and the us talking to each other. So the production quality was awful. Yet the podcast started taking off because the content, once you got past the production issues, was really good. So once I saw our numbers starting to go up, I had 15 weeks worth of content because we aired once a week. And I said, we need to make this a real show. So then, you know, we produced the audio, we added music, we added intros and outros. We made it sound like a real, we did editing and made it sound with good audio quality and made it sound like a real real radio show, which is the essence of what a podcast is. And it took off from there. And then we said, you know what, this is working really well. Let's start doing it for our clients.
So if you're expecting the business to triple over the next several years, and one of our listeners wants to get in with you and work in a – I have a specific client that I'm thinking about that might be ideal. He runs a service business here in Fort Myers. What can he expect to pay?
For us to do all of the work and do it for him, and all he has to do is show up and do the interview once a week is $1,000 a month.
So you do 4 interviews a month, and you make the show available on your network, on some network, or what?
It's on iTunes. It's on Google Play. It can be any other place. It's on YouTube. It can be any other. It'll be on their own website. And then if it turns out that the show is big enough that advertising is a viable option, we will help them with that. And if not, we'll do all of the other ways that we monetize a local small business podcast.
Okay.
And then we'll obviously, after we've done enough episodes, we'll turn the show into a book and do the book launch for them. And the book will be on Amazon as a physical book, and it'll be on Kindle as an ebook.
You know, our show started as a book. We went the reverse way. Our show started as a book and it's become a podcast.
I haven't thought
it's
of
funny
that
way.
Funny. We should go after all. We should start talking to authors and say, turn your book into a show. That's a great idea.
That's why you're here.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. We're learning a lot of fascinating things. Go ahead, Dan. I have a lot of questions, but I know you do as well, so you go first.
I'm just curious about from your years of experience, Seth, we get about 600,000 downloads a month on our show. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that are listening today or will download this later and they're saying, gee, you know, maybe I should consider this. But, you know, who is there an ideal candidate for what your services are? And are there people that just should stay away from it?
Yes and yes. So our ideal clients are generally professional practices or small business owners who are trying to want to become the authority in their marketplace and generate more referrals and more customers. Who wouldn't do it if the transaction value isn't high enough than to justify the expense that I would. So, for example, I have a local chicken and wing pizza place, we do phenomenally well for them in Facebook ads. I wouldn't have them do a podcast because the transaction value isn't high enough where if we suddenly sold 10 or 20 or 30 more pizzas a week, it's not going to move his needle very much.
Mm-hmm. Good insight. Great insight. Because I think there are people in many types of businesses who hear somebody like you or anybody and they say, well, this is a great new idea. I should probably do that. And have you ever told somebody, no, I don't think it's a good idea?
Yeah, we told our chicken pizza place not to do it. We've had, we told them not to. We've had some folks in the financial services industry who, for whatever reason, their compliance department wouldn't let them do the podcast part. They would let them do the interviews, and they would let them turn it into a book and let us market the book, but they wouldn't let them air the interviews as a podcast. So every broker-dealer, as you know, is different and has different rules. Some we've had no problem with, and others said, no, you can't air it as a show.
Yeah, people concerned that it's investment advice and there are specific rules under the SEC about advisors getting...
Exactly, and we make sure when we script the interviews that that's not a problem.
There are
some broker-dealers who say you can't put this on iTunes because we can't control that it won't be seen in states you're not licensed in, for example.
Right, that's right. That's right. That's true. So I know that because I am one, and I know that I don't talk about things specific, but talk about things in general. So where do you think this implementation of the players, the audio, the iTunes in the cars is what's going to triple the business? And that's because people are looking for something other than traditional commercial radio?
Correct. I think it's that. I mean, that number isn't coming from us. That number is coming from Apple, and I'm pretty sure, and they're connecting that with the car manufacturers, and that's where they came up with the number from. It isn't something we made up. I think it's not just Apple CarPlay. I think it's also the advent of, you know, ubiquitous smartphone access around the world. So there are many, I mean, everybody's got a smartphone now, and that market penetration is going nowhere but up in countries other than the U.S. So I think that combined with it being available natively in new cars is going to take it even higher.
So let me, I don't know how much time we have left, but let me ask you another question.
We got more than enough time, Dan. We got another 7-8 minutes.
Okay. So let me go down a new path. How do you help your clients? And let me rephrase this. Would I be correct in assuming that you do both talent and you represent products or customers that need representation?
Yes.
That makes sense. So you sell commercial time and you also produce shows.
Correct.
Okay. So in a podcast today, what's the going rate for commercial time?
$1 per 1,000 listeners for a 30-second spot.
$1 per 10,000 listeners.
No. So $1 per 1,000.
$1 per 1,000.
So if you've got 600,000 listeners, you should be getting $6,000 for a 30-second spot.
Okay. And if I we had another show that was on one station. We're now on 11 stations. So that if you said $6,000, do you say $6,000 and you take 11 stations, make the math simple, was the 10 stations, the advertiser is actually buying 10 stations for $60 a station.
I would say if you are on 10 different, I think we're talking about something different because we're talking, that sounds like radio advertising to me, which has different metrics because station sounds like a radio term as opposed to a podcast.
But we have
combined.
We have podcasts, and we're on 11 radio stations throughout the country. Both.
Okay, so then I would think the radio stations would handle advertising in their local market, and if you wanted to go for a national advertiser, are they advertising on all 10, in which case do we charge them 10 times as much and they're paying you $60,000?
No.
Or are we talking about just advertising on the podcast part of the show?
We're talking both. They'll be advertising simultaneously on both the radio show in 11 markets and the podcast.
I would say you're sitting on a gold mine that it sounds like you may not have tapped yet.
No.
No question.
No. We have been going at the rate of 75,000 downloads last month per show.
I'll be your guinea pig. I'll be your first advertiser.
Well, off the air, we should probably talk to you because we're growing pretty rapidly. We think we have one of the few small business shows on in the entire country, and we're running about 600,000 downloads a month and growing from there. I don't have Apple Play in my latest car. It wasn't offered, and I just got it 6 months ago. And it's a Japanese car, so I'm guessing
that may be why. I don't know.
Anyway, but I agree with you because as my wife and I travel, at one time we used Sirius Satellite and we turned it off. But we do an awful lot of non-broadcast listening. We love audiobooks in the car. And we listen to podcasts of shows that we have downloaded from our phones or whatever, so that the experience in our car is different today than it was 2 years ago.
Absolutely.
It's not so much. We use the satellite imaging for GPS to tell us when we've got trouble, but we use either Audible or iTunes or whatever much more so than listening to any local radio, even when we're going back and forth from the island. And I could understand, but what I think what you're saying, and if I'm putting words in your mouth, please correct me, but I think what you're saying is that something that I have always believed, and I don't take credit for being the person who thought of it, content is king. And if you've got if you've got the right content, the world will beat its path to your door. If you don't have the right content.
Well, as long as you've got the right marketing of that content, because the best in stock picker in the world isn't Warren Buffett. It's some guy who's got better returns, but he didn't know how to tell anybody, so he's managing his own portfolio and no one knows he exists.
Right, right. There are also people, I think that there are people who are afraid of this new medium. Just like the buggy whip members, manufacturers were afraid of automobiles. Because this concept of I'm curious as to whether or not, it just seems to me as an observation, huge opportunity that isn't being taken care of, what I call on an aggressive basis, and that's probably the wrong word.
I agree with what you're saying. You're absolutely right.
Well, what I want to say is that corporate America is not using that capability very well.
We've started experimenting with branded content where a big company will have its own show and we'll tell a narrative through the episode. It's not an interview. We tell a narrative and a story through those episodes, which gets people hyper engaged in whatever that product is.
And we clearly have seen the impact of streaming in the political environment. I think it was one of the ways that won the election for Mr. Trump.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Dan, let me jump in. And do you think podcasts will evolve into local podcasts and international podcasts? Or how do you see the market dividing out?
It already has. I think it's just like cable originally. We had three channels, and then now we've got 500, and there's a fishing channel. I mean, there's a channel for tons, whatever sub-niche someone can create that's got enough viewership, enough people in it to justify viewership. I think podcasts are the same way. They've already started to splinter. And I think as we get more and more listeners and more shows, it'll just keep doing that, which is a great thing for us and a great thing for advertisers, because what better way to reach an ultra micro niche targeted group of people than through a show that's specifically for them. So I don't have to waste money on a national newspaper campaign if all I really wanted to reach were Elvis impersonators in Temecula, California.
Okay, Seth, let me ask you one more question. Are we in America ahead of the curve, behind of the curve, and the rest of the world in podcasting?
We're creating the curve.
We're creating the curve. So is there an opportunity for podcast overseas?
It's bigger because we don't have the market penetration overseas that we do here. There are more podcasters here than anywhere else. There are more listeners right now here, but there, as obviously we only have a small percentage of the world's population, I personally have no international podcasting, you know, doing a podcast specifically in an overseas market, but I think it's absolutely another untapped gold mine.
I have a friend that Don and I both have been on his show numerous times, Bill Martinez, which is syndicated on 280 stations in the United States, but he's syndicated overseas in Europe and almost as many outlets as he has domestically. He's got one of the biggest operations in the world, and nobody knows about, I mean, a lot of people know about him here in the radio business, but his overseas business is just exploding.
It's the wave of the future.
Yeah.
Seth, your website again for our listeners and how they can reach you?
Yep, the book is Market Domination for Podcasting. It's on the shelves at Barnes & Noble, or you can get a free copy at marketdominationllc.com/podcast. And if you want to talk to us about transforming your marketing and growing your business, just straight marketdominationllc.com will work.
Thank you.
Dan Perkins here with your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. Are you having trouble growing your business? Do you have a mentor? Sometimes running a small business can be overwhelming. You need a mentor. A business mentor can help you in many facets of your business. So here's your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. The SBA has a free program called SCORE. These individuals give of their time and share their experiences to create the next generation of small business owners who help grow the American economy. SCORE is the nation's largest network of volunteer expert business mentors. It provides free and confidential business consulting. These volunteers will work with individuals on starting a business, solving business problems, and growing a business. Visit www.score.org and you may just hit a home run. This has been your Recalculating Small Business Tip of the Day. I'm Dan Perkins. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Raising capital and keeping ahead of financial stress is a constant small business worry. Here to talk about a solution is Chris Meyer, CEO and co-founder of Magella Loans. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, tell us, I know you have an announcement to make, but tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, the recent alliance you made, and where people can reach you and your company. That's a lot, but I'm sure you can handle it.
I can certainly take a stab. My name is Chris Meyer. I'm the CEO of McGillow Loans, and we're an anonymous search engine for loans that matches borrowers with FDIC-insured banks without placing any of your personal financial information on the site. So no name, no phone number, social security number is placed on our site, and then we place the borrower in control. So that is to say, once he receives the proposals from the banks, the borrower chooses, not the other way around. And the genesis of all this happened from me as a business owner. I own a couple of businesses in Northern California, and I got about 14 loans over a 10-year period. And I did the same thing everyone does. They go to their local banks. They give them their entire financial life, everything in a little packet, 3 years tax returns, 3 years business tax returns, personal financial statements, every cent that you owe and own. And you hand it to a banker, a young kid brings it back to the bank, and you wait a couple months for a term sheet from a bank. And once I would receive these term sheets, I would then organize them in a Excel spreadsheet and choose the best bank to go with. And after a while, I said, you know, there's got to be a better way. There has to be a search engine out there. And I went to my friend at my kid's school, a guy named Dean Tsoukas, and I said, hey, does this exist? He looked around, and he said, no, you want to build it? I said, let's do it. So that was the genesis of Megillah. And again, an anonymous search engine for loans that you place your information in, and within 24 to 48 hours, you get proposals from FDIC-insured banks. So it's it takes that 2 to 3 months of reconnaissance of waiting from a bank, and it reduces it to 24 hours. It's quite a convenient tool.
And Dan, I'm going to let you start off the talking. It's fascinating, and I just want to digest it.
Thank you, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. I really have to somewhat parrot your experience, only from a different perspective. Different perspective. I'm not going to mention any names of any online companies. But the information that you have to fill to get your four offers, you basically have signed away that information forever.
Correct.
And it's being sold multiple times. I'm still getting people who are telling me on the phone that I understand you're interested in refinancing your house. I said, no,
right.
But it says here that you inquired. And I said, yeah, how many years ago?
Right.
And so it's extremely frustrating because it makes you to be reluctant to even want to go to one of those search engines and fill out anything because you're going to get hounded to death. So
yeah, and that was the key to us, you know, when starting out. We felt, Dean and I felt like we were guys that could get loans, and we didn't want to lay ourselves prostrate in front of these banks and have them rake us over the coals and have all of our personal information. It's so vital that we don't put this information on the internet. I mean, you've obviously experienced it. Your story has been told to us, if I could even go into just ad nauseum, by various people in various walks of life. And there's no need for it. It just does not have to happen anymore. We're going to give the bank a snapshot of what we look like. They're looking for a certain type of loan. The lenders on our platform have preset the criteria of the borrower and or entity that they're looking for to lend to. And only when those two match does the borrower have this nice, perfectly generated, what we call MAG chart, which is essentially a unified term sheet. And the borrower being in control is the key to this whole thing, right? The anonymity is certainly one, But the borrowing control is really a great thing because, look, if you can get a loan, why do you need people calling you? You know, it's just.
You remember there was. Do you remember? I don't know how old you are, but I'm 72. Yeah, 72. I have been told a gazillion times that you have to prove to the bank you don't need the money in order to get the money.
Isn't that true? I mean, that's the quintessential statement of the lifetime. I mean, it's unbelievable what they do. Or, you know, they'll find the one thing in you're a 740 credit score, and they're going to find that one thing that says, well, the underwriters aren't going to like this. And you're like, really? So, yeah, it sounds like our stories are very similar.
Yeah. So how do you police, if that's probably a very good word for it, police the customer experience to make sure that these banks that you're working with are doing what they're supposed to be doing?
Well, I think that the best way is that the borrowers kind of give us feedback. If they're the policing of the system is really the people who use it. We generally only use FDIC insured banks, so they're the large banks in the country. We haven't found that there's any sort of bait and switching. We found we're pretty reputable people, or very reputable people, giving us perfect terms. It really hasn't been an issue at all. The minute you would have any sort of bait and switch, if there was such a thing, I think you would find it on social media. You know, we have just been very, very lucky that the lenders have been very true to form. Now, granted, it's not what people typically call an offer, right? That is a legal term of art, and we want no part of offers. This is a proposal. It's just a ballpark of what we're working with. Ultimately, that borrower is going to have to go or get his information to that lender, and that's where the rubber meets the road, right? If you're lying, well, you're in the wrong place. You've wasted everyone's time. But we're just not finding that. We're finding, again, kind of geared to that plus 680 credit score, 700 credit score borrower who would not have a problem getting a loan.
So when you look at what you're doing, I'm going to use myself as a another example of recent experience. Again, I won't name the bank. I have north of 800 credit score, and have had it for a long time. And I wanted to expand my home equity line, so I jumped through all the hoops, and they said, we don't think we want to do this. I said, okay. 10 days later, I got an offer from the same bank to refinance the loan. So clearly one side of the shop didn't know what the other side of the shop was doing. Do you find that a problem with big banks?
We do find that. I mean, that's being very candid with you. I think these are such large and some people would say venerable or not venerable institutions in America, but they are complex silos within themselves, and we find that the people within the banks don't know the other people in the banks as much. And each bank is structured very differently. That is to say that some are very much the Wild West with their loan officers. You go out, you know, you eat what you kill. It's like that. And others are very structured and, oh, I'm sorry, this loan officer covers this concentric circle around Austin, Texas. You know, they're very, very different and disparate infrastructures of these large companies. I will say in finding out about this over the last two and a half years, we found out that the key, and this is where McGilla comes in, is that they're very, very inefficient internally, that they do want to lend money, that they just need to find the right people, and they have a hard time finding those people. And the beauty, I think, of McGilla is that it is this objective marketplace where people can come and they can get a clear picture of the lending in America or their city at that moment. the great example I give is something, you know, you don't even think about as a layperson borrower, is that these banks have these massive internal portfolios, right? And the minute that they are light in residential in San Francisco, someone from above says, hey, man, let's go into San Fran and buy out the residential real estate market in San Francisco starting May 1st. But what we always say is, how would you as a layperson in San Francisco know that X bank is buying out the residential real estate market unless you walked in there, happened to walk in there and see balloons, you know, in their branch office? So that's where McGilla comes in. You don't we don't understand who's moving what part of portfolio and where this bank is aggressive in the marketplace. But McGilla now gives you that benefit.
How do you know?
We just know what the banks offer. Yeah, I mean, that's it. The banks are ultimately the ones that are making the offer. So we are just providing the marketplace for them to get the borrowers.
Have you considered pairing with fintech lenders?
So specifically, like, are you talking like a Celtic or a Web?
Well, somebody that's got equity capital from a venture capital or private equity, and they're going out and they're doing mortgages and they're trying to buy market share. They're
sure.
Not a bank as in a classic brick and mortar. They're offering financials and services on the web without brick and mortar. And
yes, and so typically there are two major. I mean, Celtic Bank is and Web Bank are two of the larger ones, and they're industrial loan companies based out of Utah. So that is a model, and I think it's a good model. I think looking long term, I think the Feds are going to have a hard time with that. They're already looking to crack down on those because while they are FDIC insured, they don't come under the purview of the regulators of the Feds, and I don't think the Feds like that. At least that's been the advice of our attorneys in Washington. So I think there's going to be some crackdown. I think that everyone understands that fintech lending is here to stay, but we have to figure out how, or at least the Feds want to figure out, how do we get that under our purview to protect consumers.
Yeah, and you're raising a very important question, not so much about fintech. Is the regulatory oversight? I had recently the opportunity or the challenge, depending on your perspective, to try and get some information from the FDIC and the Comptroller of the Currency, which basically regulate the banks. And
sure.
FDIC never returned the phone calls. And I found that the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the ultimate governing item, was extremely responsive and helped me gather information that I needed to respond to a potential client. But I just wonder if the regulatory environment, that the regulators are so far behind the development of the technology and alternatives that the banking model as we know it is no longer a functional model.
Well, as a fintech platform, we totally agree. We think that brick and mortar banking is dying, and will continue to die. I think there will be a stronger centralization into metropolitan areas. Of course, I think the beauty of fintech is that, you know, we're going to be doing everything electronically. The key to that is exactly what is sort of the basis of McGilla, is that anonymity. And I think we have to figure all that out. But there is no reason that banking, especially in the lending world, especially in the small business world, cannot be a straight to underwriting concept. And that's kind of where McGilla comes in. Yeah. We advocate a straight to underwriting concept with McGilla at the forefront to find the borrowers, but let's get them an answer quicker, faster, without giving them, you know, my first pint of blood.
if you want to buy a house in America today, I live in Florida, and I've lived in New Jersey and Ohio and other places, and if you want to buy a house, you have to cut down a tree to get the paper to handle the transaction. It seems to me that this is all so archaic, so unproductive, and so ludicrous. Are the changes coming in the way we process transactions?
Absolutely. I think they're closer than you realize. And I think that is the transition we're coming at. I would just say, you know, I hear you blowing off steam. These are large moving ships, and they can't make that turn so fast. And we have to be there, and we have to educate them, and we have to educate the consumer public who is used to doing it the old-fashioned way, right?
Right.
There has to be a trust involved, and there has to be a transition. Every technology needs some sort of education, and we are in the education period. And I think that's kind of why we want to brand ourselves with someone like Experian, right? Experian equals trust in our world. So we want that. We want that kind of trust, and as a smaller company, having sort of that big brother of Experian giving us that cachet of trust, that's right in our wheelhouse. That's where we want to be, and we believe we're in a good position.
Don, you wanted to ask a question.
Well, yeah, I've got several questions, and not just to fill airtime, but you also came here to say about an announcement Megillah has, and we never gave you a chance to say it.
Well, that's what I just kind of roughly alluded to with our partnership with ID Notify and Experian ID Notify partnership. And basically, you know, again, we're just trying to hit on the fact that we need to establish trust, and anonymity and trust are two huge things in America. Partnering with a large company like Experian for a small company like us gives us that cachet in the industry. And we just want people to be very mindful of what they're putting on the internet. And, you know, these options of internet surveillance or social network monitoring, lost wallet services, these are all just small pieces into the larger basket of trust. And because we're founded upon this anonymous platform idea, we felt that there's no one better in the industry than Experian. So we're very happy and thrilled to be offering it to our borrowers.
Well, that's good to hear. But I guess the question, Dan's been going one direction. I guess I want to go the other and ask, what is the average interest rate that people are paying today?
It all depends on the type of loan you're looking for. I mean, in the residential world, you know, they're roughly around 4%, I would say, right now. In the commercial world, maybe a little bit lower. But it all depends upon, you know, the borrower. There's a certain snapshot of a person that they're looking for, and they are apportioning their rates commensurate with the risk involved in the borrower or the asset that they're insuring. Makes total sense to me. But the rates are, you know, again, you guys are old enough to know the rates right now are just, comparatively speaking, over a lifetime, it's just unbelievably low, right?
So correct.
You guys lived through the Carter administration, so you're used to those 15-18% lenders, or you remember those certainly. But no, I mean, I think comparatively speaking, we tend to get caught up in, the Fed's going to move and it's going to go up a quarter or a basis point. And, you know, how does this end? Really? I mean, over the grand scheme of things, these are great rates and they have been for quite some time. If you want to refi or you want a mortgage or you want to start a business, this is it. You're in the wheelhouse. Do it now.
Well, that's the question that came across my computer. But a woman who's been baking cookies for the last 5 years and now wants to go in and buy a cookie oven and a large-scale a masher or a mixer and renovate and wants to raise $20,000. Can she do that through your operation?
To be honest with you, it's a little bit more difficult in ours. Ours, we deal specifically with FDIC insured banks, the large banks in the country, the largest banks in the country, and typically they want 2 to 3 years in business, 3 years of or 2 years of profitability. So that is considered a startup, really, and that is a little more difficult. We know that there are platforms out there that is in their wheelhouse. Generally, interest rates are significantly higher, so it's a challenge. It's a challenge, and we always say, hey, if you can, you know, work the family, work the friends, work that network, and see if they believe in your cookies are halfway decent, that they would warrant a little bit of an investment, because that's going to be way cheaper money than some of these platforms that we're seeing around.
Your website again, and how people can reach you and your company?
Yes, my company is MagillaLoans.com, and my name's Chris. And please look us up. We'd love to help you match you with an FDIC insured lender. And now is a great time. So let's keep America great and get those small businesses going.
Well, this is radio, so will you spell out your website for our listeners?
Yes, it's MAGILLA Loans, LOANS.com.
How did you come up with the name?
Well, there's an old Yiddish term, the whole Megillah, meaning the whole thing. And we liked it. It was a big name. And it kind of just stuck. We had it as a placeholder for a while. And then people said, wow, I love the name. There was a cartoon back in the 60s and 70s called Megillah the Gorilla.
Yes.
And kind of just stuck
sir.
From there.
Chris,
okay,
thank you
for having me. This is Chris Meyer with Megillah Loans.
Well, Dan, what do you think about today's guest?
I thought they were terrific. We had great diversity. We had some really good ideas on small business and what they can do with credit and how they can save money with the gentleman from Spent. So I think there was a lot of good stuff. Again, continuing the idea that we are on the air to try and help small businesses grow their businesses and start them. And again, we had content today that dealt with both. And as in the past, if you didn't get all of this show, you can go to our website, recalculating.biz, and look at past shows and expand your education, how you can be better at what you're doing in a small business.
Agreed. Great show, Dan.
You know, Don, one of the things we need to do is remind people they can go to recalculating.biz and they can listen to this show and any show that we've put on the air. So go to recalculating.biz and download our videos where you can actually see and hear the subject matter that we're discussing.
Dan, tell us a little bit about your new book.
The book literally just went on for sale on Amazon. It's called Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? I believe it's the first book of its kind written for children of ages 9 to 12 dealing with dementia. And it's done as a mystery. And it's about two little girls, Hudson and Charlotte, who come face to face with trying to figure out what's happening to James's grandmother, who has dementia. The children or grandchildren are the forgotten part of this puzzle of dementia. Mom and dad are spending so much time trying to figure out how to help grandma and grandpa. They pay less attention to the needs of their grandchildren, understand what's happening to grandma and grandpa. So hopefully this book will not only help 9 to 12 year olders, but also it's also written for an entire family and has a whole series of programs and things that families can do together to preserve the memory of their grandparents. Available at Amazon.com.
And tell them the name of the book again.
Why Can't Grammy Remember Me?
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.